of losing money in the stock market roller coaster? Frustrated with the government taxing you into oblivion? Worried about inflation? How do you prepare for so many financial uncertainties? Welcome to the show that will help you develop your game plan. The Financial Quarterback with Josh Jelinski. Josh is a noted financial advisor and president of the Jelinski Advisory Group, and he's here to answer your questions. Call into the show at 800-321-0710. 800-321-0710. Now let's kick off your financial future. Here's Josh Jelinski.
Hi, everybody. This is Josh Jelinski, the Financial Quarterback. And we're being joined by legendary podcast host since 2014, David Stein, founder of Money for the Rest of Us. So in 2014, I had a guy who had a podcast on finance, a million downloads like you since 2009. Everybody wants a podcast now, but 2014, it was not easy to do. It was kind of a new thing. So describe your origin story in podcasting, David.
For sure. So I left the institutional investment business in 2012. I worked for an asset management firm. I was the chief investment strategist and retired. I called myself retired for a little bit in my mid-40s. But missed teaching. I worked with a lot of endowments and foundations, institutional assets, and was a guest on a podcast called Listen Money Matters, and realized at the time, you know, people are getting these data plans on their phones, and as a result, all in data. We thought, well, you know, I like being a guest. Let me launch a podcast and see how it works. And timing was good, and it much better timing back then than it is trying to launch a podcast now.
Definitely. So, what about your work in institutional money? Describe that.
Yeah, I did almost just over 16 years. So I joined a firm in Cincinnati. It's called FEG Advisors now, and they were a traditional sort of pension consultant working mostly with not-for-profits. And then we launched one of the first outsourced asset management businesses in 2003. So I sort of put that product together, me and a few partners. We launched a track record, and so I ran that for just about a decade before leaving in 2012. And so we had assets that we manage in terms of just sort of with these not-for-profits taking discretion, you know, within the confines of their policy statements. And it was very much an active allocation approach, multi-asset classes, and they continue to run that product today. It has, you know, multiple billions of dollars in that service.
Do you miss it?
Oh, managing money? No, not at all. It's hard to do because you're very much compared to a benchmark every month, and I just got tired of the rat race of that. So I much prefer doing what I do now.
Let's talk about benchmarking, and I do want to talk about what you're doing now. The average person, Money for the Rest of Us, they hear benchmark. No, most people don't even benchmark. They don't even know what benchmarking is. And then when they benchmark to the wrong thing. Talk about that.
Within the institutional space, you have these. Let's say a typical university endowment, there's an investment committee, and every quarter they're getting a report and they're showing, here's how we did. You know, here's our annualized return for our endowment. And here's a market benchmark made up of indexes. It's usually some type of weighted index made up of, let's say, MSCI indices on the stock side, Bloomberg indices on the bonds. And, or it could be other asset classes, including in that. And the goal, I mean, these committee members measure success. Did the portfolio outperform that index over a quarter, year, 3 year, 5 years? They're also measuring against their peers. How did other endowments do? And so as new individuals, we don't do that. And which I think is a good thing because we care about making money. Did our portfolio grow? And are we going to meet our retirement savings goals? And so, but the institutional world, because you just have these volunteers coming, they are very focused on, if we're paying fees to advisors, did they add value above a passively managed index? Most individual investors are already, you know, they're using ETFs or let's say an index fund. And so it's less of an issue. And it certainly isn't the mindset of individuals by any means.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you get out of the FEG world? Layoffs or?
No. So I joined in 95. I became a partner and on our executive team by 98. We sold the firm to help our founding partners exit in 2002. And then we bought it back in 2005 at half what we sold it for. And, you know, by, you know, the leveraged buyout. And so 2011-ish, you know, my retirement number had been hit. I was just ready to move on. So my partners bought me out.
Did you do some of the things that you talk about on a weekly basis on Money for the Rest of Us? Did you do those tips then?
No, I mean, how I teach investing now is how we managed assets, you know, at FEG, especially the outsourced asset management division. So it was very much active allocation, but, you know, making maybe 2 to 3 changes a year, focusing on portfolio drivers, expected returns. And, you know, we were, you know, back in 2003, we were using ETFs to implement our portfolio. And we actually got pushback from institutions like, well, you know, ETFs, that's a retail product. And now institutions use ETFs all the time. And so we were ahead of the curve in terms of using ETFs. And really, you know, the impetus of that product was, you know, we were traditional consulting, selecting active managers. And I got the idea kind of 2002 to say, well, what if we just took the best ideas from our best managers? And, you know, these are managers on a recommended list. So this was an equity product. And we'll just get their top 5 to top 10 holdings, and we'll put together a portfolio, and we'll get on, you know, a turnkey asset management program, and we'll run this portfolio. You know, best ideas, high conviction ideas. And so I spent a summer, and it was the summer 2002, backtesting it. We used Barra software at the time, which was really a way to kind of backtest and control your risk. And lo and behold, there wasn't any excess return. There was no alpha in this product. And that was incredibly discouraging, because either we were lousy at picking managers, or there was something else going on. And what that something else was is, you know, much of what's considered excess return or outperformance from an active manager is not due to security selection. It's due to their factor exposure. Is, you know, what's their, is it a value tilt? Is it momentum? It's a yield. And by combining 100 stocks in a portfolio and constraining the risk, we basically diversified all that factor exposure to where we couldn't exceed the benchmark net of fees. And so that's when we said, well, we can develop our own factor exposure using ETFs. And that's what we did. We could put a value tilt on, or just focus on, you know, what were the areas of the market most attractive, you know, back in 2003. 2004, it was emerging markets, it was small cap, and that was enough to add excess return, and we attracted a good following and grew a really good, solid business there.
What would be your drivers for excess return now that you see? Because I think some of this is like, you know, you see the French FAMA and the dimensional people. Some of me thinks that all of these things that people got for excess return in the last 10 years will be different in the next 10 years.
Well, first off, I don't benchmark portfolios anymore, which is good, because had I been benchmarking, I mean, I know what factors outperformed in the past decade. It's been growth and momentum and U.S., which is why any manager that was focused on value, non-U.S., they've underperformed. And so, you know, I'm grateful I'm not managing benchmarks. And, you know, we run some model portfolios on our membership community, you know, some adaptive portfolios versus, you know, static. And yeah, the adaptives have had much lower risk, but they've also had a value tilt. And because that, you know, going forward, you know, what's driven the outperformance of growth, let's say the U.S., the MSCI USA Growth Index over the past decade, has certainly the earnings growth has come in around 6% for that, but there's been an additional 3 percentage points annual return just because the price to earnings ratios have got more expensive. In other words, it's just It's the PE is getting expensive has added 3 percentage points annualized to U.S. growth performance over the past decade. And so if you were overweight growth, you did very, very well as investors were willing to pay more and more for that prospective earnings growth. And now with the AI sort of boom, you're seeing it even more.
Does anything worry you about, you know, portfolios being so tilted towards the seven, Magnificent Seven?
I've had two experiences in the last 3 months where financial advisors that I wasn't working with them, but they were working with friends of mine, they recommended overweighting growth in the client portfolio, which the last time I saw that was kind of late 90s. And we, you know, some investors got very, very hurt because growth again was doing so well. Couldn't fail until we had the internet bubble burst in 2000. And that's where you saw value then outperform for the next really 8 years, 9 years until we've had this extended growth thing. And again, I mean, growth is growing faster than value. The question is, how much do you pay for that growth?
Are you more of a growth guy or value? Would you describe yourself as a value investor?
Sort of agnostic. I have both. I have more of a value tilt, but I added some growth in my personal portfolio last summer because I realized with AI that there's something there that could dramatically increase productivity across the global economy. And I don't mind putting money in growth just in case, right, to participate, but it's not going to be the bulk of my portfolio. I think that's imprudent. So having both, in some ways, to manage regret, right? So I remember doing this in the year 2000. It's like, you know, we were value tilted. I remember adding some growth, you know, the two most expensive growth stocks I could find, just in case the world really was different this time. And they got obliterated.
What were the stocks, if you don't mind me saying?
One was JDS Uniphase. What was the other one? I don't remember what the other one was. Might have been Cisco.
Pets.com. Yeah.
Yeah. No, no, no. It was infrastructure.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah, you know, USA Growth Index is selling at a PE of 38. All right, that's almost two standard deviations more than its long-term average of 22. And so, and that's being driven by the mega cap stocks and bubble. As we saw back in 99, bubbles can go on for a long time. And maybe, you know, the way that I think about stock investing is via index fund or ETF or an individual stock. But let's say an individual stock, NVIDIA. The only way that stock is going to outperform is if it does better than what everyone expects, the consensus on the earnings front. And granted, in its recent earnings release, it did way better than everybody expected. But will that continue for the next 10 years? And will it do better than everyone expects? Or the overall growth index with a PE of 38. We know what happens when a growth stock disappoints. It plummets. And so it isn't a question of, and this is what I taught back in 2000, I wrote a paper for our clients on this because I wanted to know, you know, is value dead or should we just be doing growth? And you realize, no, I mean, the studies show and the theory is that it isn't about whether something's growing, it's what you're paying for it and whether it will do better than what everybody expects, because that's what stock market is. It's a consensus weighing mechanism and it's got to do better than what's already priced in. And right now, there's some pretty exuberant expectations priced into the big cap growth stocks, particularly US. Outside the US, in the market's actually fairly reasonably priced. But U.S. growth is definitely expensive right now, and maybe it will do better than everybody expects. I don't know. That's why I still own some.
What about, I was just thinking, I had a call from my friend. I'm going to do a podcast on this. Google SEO guy. We had about an hour conversation on what he believes to be the decline of Google. Think about this. kids now, I went to a debate on my daughter. My daughter's in like a national forensics debate team. She's 15. And I just pulled out Microsoft Copilot. And the debate was, should rationalism be valued higher than empiricism? You know, one of these, you know, heady debate topics. And I plugged the resolution into ChatGPT, well, Microsoft's version of it. And out came this, it was like what I used to write for a report, or what you probably wrote for a report in high school or college. I got it for free. And as I heard the kids at the debate, it wasn't like when they were Googling. So when I went to college, Google was a debater's best friend. And I did kind of amateurish. I wasn't on the college debate team. I did like a amateur kind of debate thing. And I'm amazed at how Google basically developed, because kids in their teens and 20s replaced the library with Google search. And then all of a sudden it hit me. Google search is going to be replaced by OpenAI or ChatGPT. So I do think when we put so much on these seven stocks, what if Google gets cut in half, you know? It's hard to fathom.
Well, I think it's a huge risk. It's a huge risk. I will ask ChatGPT first before I go to Google, because I just want the answer, and I want a dialogue. Now, I don't trust ChatGPT 100%, just like I don't trust Google 100%. But I think investors that are companies that are SEO-based companies, that I was looking at NerdWallet, for example. They're sort of in our space, financial media. And if your business is depending on an algorithm, that worries me, in the sense of driving traffic. And you know, as we look to structure our business, we don't want to be dependent on an algorithm for success anymore, because it's incredibly hard to compete on that, and you can't control your destiny.
Yeah, and then they're changing the levers. Like this SEO guy was even telling me, they're changing things, which may portend that they're struggling. So you're the founder of Money for the Rest of Us. What are you doing lately that's occupying your studies for the podcast? It's exciting you.
Podcasting is a tough business right now. You mentioned back in 2014 that typically there were maybe 50,000 new podcasts a year. And in 2020, there was 1 million new podcasts created, and another 1 million in 2021. And so this is a medium where the supply of podcasts is growing faster than listeners. And you're seeing it in ad rates, and you're seeing it in downloads per episode. And then the podcast companies are struggling because Apple changed their app. And so they're not automatically downloading old episodes anymore. And so when we look at what's exciting us, it's not podcasting at Money for the Rest of Us. I love podcasting, but it's not a great business. We launched a fintech startup back in July called Asset Camp, where we're taking, basically, we've built an app so where an individual investor can analyze stock index funds and ETFs and understand the drivers. So do a 10-year attribution and figure out, well, just like I did with growth, you know, the U.S. Growth Index, what percent of the 10-year return was driven by dividends? What percent was driven by earnings growth? What percent was driven by valuation changes and currency impact? And this is tools that as institutional investors, you're just used to having, but they cost tens of thousands of dollars per year. And as individual investors, even if they're investing in index funds, they don't really understand what they're buying, or just the basic, you know, what's under the hood of an index or an index fund or an ETF in terms of dividends and earnings growth and valuations. Is it cheap? Is it not? How do I rebalance? And so what excites us is providing tools to individuals that were previously only available to institutional investors, and combining it with the education so that we can help individuals.
That's funny that excites you. To me, that would be a tougher business.
No, because in some ways we're in the same business. Like we've always run a premium membership education along with the podcast. So, you know, the podcast, it's been going on for 10 years and, you know, there's a free version, but we also do a paid version, you know, with a kind of a Q&A episode. But you know, as part of that membership community, now I couldn't really, you know, we subscribe to a number of institutional research services, but we couldn't show a PE chart of the emerging markets, right, without getting permission from one of our providers. And so what we built was came out of frustration is we just want to be able to show the type of charts that I saw all the time as an institutional investor. Like how many standard deviations is the some segment of the market relative to its average? And so it's still a subscription business. It's an education business. It's just giving subscribers more tools so they can do more of the work themselves and they can check the work and compare it to kind of what we're saying, as opposed to just being fed, you know, whatever, you know, our view of the month is.
What are your favorite tools or indicators, other than obviously what you're building at Asset Camp? What research is influencing Asset Camp?
Well, so we've been long-term subscribers to Ned Davis Research, you know, which is very much focused on, you know, combining valuations with trends, you know, market internals. And that's how I've always managed money. So that's what we look at. We look at, you know, where are valuations and, you know, what is the consensus for earnings growth and what seems to be as at an extreme. And it's not, you know, even as an institutional manager, we would make a couple trades a year. So we're not, because we're doing allocation. We're not picking individual securities or stocks. It's an allocation decision. And so you can be patient that way as an investor. You don't have to be making changes all the time. And so, you know, we're looking out 10 years when we invest and what's attractive. And so your changes are slow. I mean, for example, we look at yields all the time. In the last year, it's the most attractive time to enter into Treasury inflation protection securities than we've seen in a decade, because finally the real yields were positive. And so we're looking at all asset classes and just looking at what are the fundamentals and what is the cash flow being generated? What's that cash flow growth? What are investors paying for that cash flow? And so it's sort of back to basics, understanding the underlying drivers of asset classes.
What asset classes do you like now? You mentioned Treasury inflation protected securities.
We like TIPS now. We certainly like non-US. If you look at sort of, you know, what's particularly cheap, non-US small cap is very attractive right now as a, you know, as somebody was going to add it. I mean, if we looked at 6 months ago, emerging markets, Latin America, the dividend yield was over 10%. And so we really liked equity REITs back in October, November, because they were the cheapest they'd been really since 2009. And, you know, they're still attractive going forward. But these pockets of super inexpensive asset class, that doesn't happen very often. And so we're mostly investing now. You know, we have equity exposure. We have, TIPS exposure. The leveraged loan space, bank loans are still attractive. You can get a yield of over 9%, and you want to use a manager that's a little more conservative. But, you know, even after expected defaults, they expected that, you know, leveraged loans, these are bank loans that have been syndicated into the market. You know, they trade in the secondary market. They're variable rate debt, so it's tied to short-term interest rates. We don't see the Fed cutting rates dramatically over the next year. And so these things will continue to yield 8 to 9% over the next year or so. And if default rates are, let's say, 3%, which is what S&P is predicting, you know, that brings the return down to, you know, to still 6, 7%. And if you have a good active manager that's more conservative, then you can earn 8, 9%. and not worry about rates getting higher because it's variable rate debt.
You like closed-end funds, ETFs on the front?
No, we have a course on our site on closed-end funds. We've talked about it on the podcast. I like closed-end funds. The problem is that the best time to buy them is when everything's sort of selling off, because closed-end funds are primarily held by retail investors, and they panic when things are looking dicey. And so then they sell the fund, and you know, a closed-end fund, there isn't a mechanism like an ETF or its price to stay close to the value of the underlying assets or the net asset value. So an ETF, there's a mechanism in place. For an open-end mutual fund, it trades at the net asset value. But a closed-end fund can sell at a 20% discount to the net asset value or a 20% premium. And so the time to buy closed-end funds is when the discount is bigger than average. And so, yeah, we like closed-end funds, but selectively. You know, I added, for example, in the leveraged loan space, the BlackRock Debt Strategies Fund, DSU, right? Well, that was at a 10% discount 2 years ago at a time when the Federal Reserve was raising rates. But now it's selling at a 3% premium. So I exited and then bought a plain vanilla leveraged loan ETF. And so I've always enjoyed closed-end funds, but you kind of have to, you know, I'll use CEF Connect to just sort of screen discounts, and you want to make sure the discount's greater than average. But it is one of the few areas as retail investors that we can get an advantage over institutions, because there's only a certain amount of liquidity in closed-end funds, so big institutions can't invest in them. It's probably a product that shouldn't exist, but because you can actually see the discount, you can pick up some good deals, you know, opportunistically.
Oh, fantastic. You mentioned overseas investing. What foreign markets do you like?
There isn't necessarily one particular. We sort of like what's not in the U.S. because it's so much more attractive. And so I can't say, you know, Argentina. There's a benefit to country diversification. And so one interesting country that is looking more and more attractive is China. Like, China's market has gone the exact opposite of the U.S. market. Now, that we did a podcast probably 5 months ago on some of the demographic headwinds that China's facing. But sometimes assets get, you know, even given headwinds, they get too cheap. And China, from that perspective, is looking, at least on a valuation basis, is looking more attractive. But, you know, I'm not ready to jump in yet. It's got to get even cheaper.
Yeah, China, and particularly China tech, it has just been obliterated. And
right,
I always tell people, like, they say good values. You know, you got Alibaba's trading cheap. You get different Chinese internet tech ETFs trading cheap, but nobody wants it. I think some of it is the ick factor of giving money to a communist country. It was funny, people are more okay with China, even though they were communists like a couple of years ago, than they are today. Just talking to retail investors, it's...
Yeah. If you look at the trailing 12-month price earnings ratio of the China, the MSCI China index, it's 10.5 compared to its long-term average of 15. It's the cheapest country in the world on a PE basis right now, or one of the cheapest. You know, the other areas that are, you know, similar, emerging markets, Latin American emerging markets value, both close to 10 PEs. So yeah, it's suddenly China's much more attractive than it was a few years ago. Because I agree, it's kind of the ick factor, but you never know.
Yeah, it's funny. People didn't care as much a few years ago about owning it, but now they're like, well, I really don't want to own any China.
You know, there are index. There's emerging markets ex China index. And we had one of our Asset Camp subscribers said, can you add this index? Because I already have 46 indexes. I mean, there's thousands we could use, but you're starting to see people, yeah, I don't want to invest in China at all.
Yeah, it's almost like become like cigarette stocks. I don't want to, you know, we have a part for our clients to put, you know, exclusions.
Right.
And probably the number one is now no China, followed by cigarettes, you know. It's funny, people talk about DEI. I don't see that as a big driver for our clients. I see like, I don't want to be in, we've had some, I don't want to be in Budweiser. I don't want to be in Disney. I don't want to be, you know, it's almost like the political issue.
Oh, right. The political is the new ESG, right?
Which I always found funny. I don't know if the guy who ran for president, Vivek, he owned a company that does, I guess, he marketed it as non-woke ETFs. Did you follow this at all?
I haven't, but it doesn't surprise me.
It owns all the same stuff as IVV, or so he has like an S&P 500 with no DEI mandate, but it owns all the same stuff that IVV owns or VOO.
You know, our view on ESG is that unless people change their behavior of what they're doing, then just buying a stock or excluding a stock because of it for what it does doesn't really make an impact. And in fact, there's an argument, and you look at Philip Morris or some of these other companies, that they get cheaper because people don't want to own them, but they're still smoking. And as a result, they still do very, very well and make even more money for investors. The way, if there's an issue that you're opposed to, the way is to actually have an impact on the company's sales, like boycotting it or getting other people not to pursue that behavior. That will definitely impact the stock return. But just not owning it in your portfolio doesn't really do anything other than make you feel better that you don't own it. But you're just owning a stock in the secondary market. I mean, as you know, this money's not going to the company. It's just you're not getting potential dividends from a company. And we saw this with, you know, our institutional clients. They would have ESG mandates, and some do. But to really impact on an ESG basis is focus on what the company does, not how their stock is trading.
Yeah, I think the better thing would be to get on like the, I guess, vote and get on the boards and use your proxy voting powers. And
all right, yeah.
But many people don't really do that. But it's interesting, the whole ESG thing, when people ask me, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of not a scam, but people think that the money is going to the company's pocket.
And right, exactly. That you're buying their stock and you're just giving them money. I mean, ESG has been around for years, but you're correct.
Well, Calvert, based out of Cincinnati, they've been around for years.
All right.
That was their whole thing, yeah.
And we did it for years at our institutional firm, but it has suddenly gotten very political to where, I mean, I guess things just do, but now it's, we did an episode a year or so ago, our Vanguard and State Street getting too powerful because or iShares, BlackRock, because they, you know, those big fund companies were suddenly taking a more active role because they own such a large percentage of the stocks because they ran index fund, and they stepped out and started being more active. And then suddenly ESG, you know, particularly on the climate front, ESG sort of became much more political. And you've seen BlackRock and Vanguard become much less active because now it's hurting their business because they're getting pushback from some of their clients, like, we don't want you to do ESG or take positions. And so it things come and go.
And you mentioned boycotts. It's funny, I don't think boycotts ever worked until recently. You know, I remember in the 90s, people wanted to boycott Disney because NYPD Blue. Do you remember that?
I remember the show. I don't remember the when they were trying to boycott Disney.
Because it was one of the first shows to expose things. And, you know, oh, Disney family friendly. But now you see the spat with DeSantis had more negative pressure on Disney stock than
right.
any boycott ever on Disney.
Or even, I guess Budweiser got boycotted to where it, you know, it pushed the Tecate, one of the Mexican beer company, Corona, to, you know, number one beer in the U.S. now.
Wow.
At least for a time, just based on the boycotts, people not wanting to own Budweiser for political reasons again.
Yeah, that was a stock I wish I bought. Constellation, the owner of Corona, you know.
Yeah.
I read on one of the newsletters years ago, you know, buy Constellation. I was like, yeah, you know, I wasn't really motivated by it. And that stock really took off. So we talked about some investing themes you like this year. Any ones that we didn't mention?
No. I mean, I think, you know, we've spent a lot of time on our podcast and community on locking in higher yields. So we're at a position where you can, for example, pick up a bullet ETF where you can lock in, you know, over 5%, looking out 5-6 years, like, let's say an investment grade corporate bond bullet ETF. So there's a set maturity date, and, you know, now's a great time. Yields are still high and they're still attractive, and we can lock those yields in. There's products to do that, to where there's even TIPS bullet ETFs, to where, you know, investors, you got that cash flow there. And so you don't have to worry about, you know, if rates fall, then you have the optionality to sell early. But if rates rise, if you own an individual bond or if you own a bullet ETF, then, you know, your gain is still locked in because you've locked in that yield. And so it's an interesting time for investing, because for the first time in many years, we can actually get yields to where we can take less risk on the stock side because we're earning 5-6% on the bonds. It's very different than 3-4 years ago when you were earning 2% on bonds and you were forced to take more risk on the stock side. The bar is higher now to take on big stock risk, because much lower risk investments have attractive yields. And that's really a big shift we've seen in the last 2 years, and a welcome shift.
Do you like any dividend paying stocks right now, or dividend paying stock ETFs?
We did an episode recently, is dividend investing dead? And you can go back 25 years and see dividend growers have outperformed non-dividend paying stocks. But over the past 10 years, non-dividend paying stocks have outperformed dividend paying stocks and stocks that, you know, grow their dividends. And it's, again, because of growth stocks, but also, you know, growth stocks have a much higher return on equity. So they've done a very good job growing earnings more than enough to offset their lower dividend yields. So I'm not, you know, we looked at dividend paying ETFs, but that's, you know, I don't own any at the moment.
Did a show on this one time on a radio show, WR, and I talked about how back in the day, like your grandmother, your mother, your father had XYZ stock that paid a dividend. And it encouraged wise investment behavior. I think of people over the years, clients who've had New Jersey Resources or PSE&G, and they've had it for 40 years and they've had those dividends and they've invested the dividends, or Con Ed. And those clients were so smart. They were regular people, invested for 40 years. They did nothing. They did drip programs. They built very nice net worth. And now we have meme stocks and crypto, and people in their 20s and 30s, they're not really getting the good education, other than places like your podcast and others, where it's like the current growth stock craze, it's almost like encouraging bad behavior.
Well, right. And exactly. You know, we talk a lot about on our show the difference between investing and speculating. Now, speculating is where there's disagreement on what the right price is. So gold, Bitcoin, futures, like commodity futures, that's speculating. And it can have a role in a portfolio. But the true workhorse of a portfolio should be cash flow. which means dividends for stocks or for equity REITs or what we can get on the credit side. And that's portfolio management. And yeah, you can have some meme stocks or cryptocurrency. And I own cryptocurrency. I have for years. But I don't want my investment success to be dependent on an asset where we can't even agree what it's worth because there's no cash flow. I mean, the beauty of dividends is at least you can value a company or you can value the asset class. And so when I say I don't own dividend paying stocks, I do. What I meant was I haven't added new dividend paying, but I've owned an emerging markets, a dividend, you know, Wisdom Tree, one of their emerging markets value dividend paying stocks. And the key to dividends is it just don't buy it just because it has a high dividend, but there needs to be some type of screen as whether the dividend is sustainable. And so there are ETFs out there that combine both. So they're looking at, yeah, attractive dividend, but also doing some type of quality screen or momentum screen to make sure they're not just buying, you know, stock that has a really high dividend because it's struggling and it's about to cut the dividend in half. And so there's a way to do it. But I agree with you, older investors, where you could just buy company and tuck it away. But you know, now we have ETFs that make it much, much easier and cost effective to do that with a lot less work. And that's why I've generally been much more focused on ETFs and closed-end funds in terms of managing assets.
Oh, that's great. The rise of the 401k millionaires, CNBC just did a study on this. What do you think about the study?
I think that it's a natural outgrowth of the decimation of defined benefit pension plans. There should be probably way, way more 401k millionaires than there are. Because if you retire with $1 million and you spend 4% as your spending rate in your first year, that's $40,000. Now, let's say you get another 20 on Social Security. If you can live on $60,000 a year, that's great. But there's a lot of areas in the country people can't live on that, and they haven't for a long time. And so we want a lot of 401k millionaires because we don't have defined pension plans like we used to, or defined benefit pension plans.
We're seeing more and more businesses go to defined benefit plans again. IBM just said, hey, we're getting back to that. I think that's a good thing. Because the average person, we have one at our company. I mean, the average person doesn't save for retirement. I mean, that's the truth.
No, they don't. And they don't. I mean, it's sort of sad that because I used to work with pension plans, and the reason why they got rid of them is because they didn't want to take the risk anymore. And it was cheaper for them to do a 401k plan and just let the employees figure it out. There's some benefits to scale, and pension plans have scale and they have professional management if they're done well and they're pooling the risk. And that's not what you get with a 401k plan. You don't get scale and you don't get to pool the risk, and you're stuck with whatever choice you made or what the market did, as opposed to there's some benefit, which is why most individual investors, when they retire, should look at immediate annuities. You know, look at something where they can get something that's pension-like, get guaranteed income for life through some type of pooled vehicle where the risk is mutualized and put together. And so it isn't just, I couldn't imagine going into retirement completely dependent on the stock market.
Yeah. And a pension or an annuity, it's not about whether you could make more on the S&P 500 versus that particular product. It's really about making sure you can live with the results. Because with a 401k, you know, I don't know how many people told me, hey, March of 2020, I sold everything in my 401k and I regret it. And they're still in cash, like today.
Oh yeah, there's people that are still in cash from 2008. They never returned to the stock market. And because we're human and we have regret. And that's, you know, back in 2008, and I'm not an insurance expert. Like, we managed money, but I remember we managed money for financial planners. And I remember going, I think it was fall 2008, 2008, going to meet with his planner's clients in Baltimore. And they were shell-shocked, these clients, because they, you know, the market was down 40, 50%. And I thought, this is stupid. Like, there's got to be a better way to manage your retirements, not to be in the stock market. I didn't know what an immediate annuity was, but I, you know, I booked a ticket to an insurance conference and started figuring out, like, what product is actually out there that can help people. And annuities, the right annuity can make sense because it brings peace of mind. And I've helped family members. You didn't hear a lot about immediate annuities because, you know, you pay the premium once and then you get a payment for the rest of your life. Mainly because it was the lowest paying commission product that insurance, you know, the insurance industry had. And so as oftentimes you see, you know, other variable annuities are being pushed, but, you know, this is a plain vanilla product that is incredibly effective and can play a role in retirement for peace of mind.
And I even saw, I saw some trailer for some movie. I guess the guy was trying to sell his movie, but the guy goes all around the country and he's interviewing people who have an annuity versus those who don't have an annuity. And apparently there's this, Tom Hegna talks about, you know, there's this psychic benefit where because you're not worried, you can actually have your money in the market and you let it grow because you're getting paid every month. You get getting mailbox money. So it kind of takes the pressure off.
Yeah, I recorded a show for premium members this morning. And the member was asking, like, what framework do you use to figure out, well, what percent of your retirement do you put in annuity? And my view is, and, you know, Wade Faw is an academic, wrote a book on this, Safety First Retirement. And the idea is you cover the bare minimum basic expenses with Social Security and annuity. So you know that the your lodging and your food is covered and healthcare. And what that does is it frees up the rest of your portfolio to invest in more aggressively. So you have the peace of mind, and then you can, you know, have more fun with the rest of the portfolio and then cover, you know, cost of living things down the road. But there is, I've definitely seen that with family members. You know, they're much more relaxed now that they don't have to worry about what the stock market's doing this year.
Yeah, and it's also like, why would you want to spend your whole retirement worried about your money, watching CNBC?
Oh, right. Or even, which is why, like, even me, like, I will buy an annuity at some point when I retire. And I love investing, but my wife doesn't love investing. So what if, you know, I pass before her, or we get to the point where, yeah, we don't want to deal with it anymore. And so there's that. If you, at 30 years retirement, that's a long time, and things change. And so to be able to lock in some guaranteed income can make sense.
Larry Kotlikoff has some phrase, I forget what he says, in his book, Money Magic or Magic Money. I always forget the title, but it's something like, and I've done this in my own life, something like safety first, where you have a certain, you know, he likes tips instead of annuities, but it's the same concept.
Right. Yeah.
Or insurance product or whatever. But if you have a margin of safety initially, so I came from nothing. So my biggest thing was, I want to have X dollars safe forever. Mm-hmm. Even though I was younger when I acquired it, because to me, I want X number untethered from the market. And then I risk the rest. It's a similar type concept.
Right.
And it has you, it causes you to have a better life. You're not looking at your portfolio. Because when you look at your portfolio, even if you're an institutional investor, you do this for a living, you get wigged out. I've had some of my smartest clients make the dumbest decisions on selling because they were keenly aware of the risks of the present day.
Well, yeah, because we're human. So Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote about this in his book, Fooled by Randomness. The fact that losing money feels worse than making money. So the same amount, you lose $100,000 versus gaining $100,000. Losing it feels way worse than the pleasure we get from gaining $100,000. And so because markets have a degree of randomness, if you're looking at a portfolio every day, and sometimes it's down, sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down big, that's sort of like putting negative, like worse feelings all the time. You're always going to feel worse when it's down than you feel good when it's up. And that can lead to very short-term behavior to try to get out. Like, I can't stand the pain anymore. I got to get out. And so it's better. We tell our members, like, look once a month. That's what I look at my portfolio once a month, just because I share my percentage weights with our members. So I have to compile the data. But looking at it daily, I think psychologically is just too intense for most of us because of just the way that it feels worse when things happen. But at the same time, I don't look at reviews for my book or for my podcast because you remember the bad reviews way more than you remember the good reviews.
My daughter was at this debate. She didn't do as well as she wanted to do. So for good laughs, you know what we read? Negative reviews of a YouTube show I did.
Oh, yeah. YouTube's brutal.
They were really rough, and it got a good laugh.
Yeah.
Out of my daughter, and it cheered her up. Anything you didn't mention that you think our audience should know about?
No, it's been an enjoyable discussion, Josh. So, we've talked on a number of points. I think the key to investing is to be patient, to understand the fundamentals, to definitely diversify. I think it's fine to participate in more speculative positions, be it cryptocurrency, gold, meme stocks, but generally less than 10% of one's portfolio. And just because we want more control over our retirement outcome and retirement savings outcomes. And we do that by focusing on cash flow generating assets, be it bonds, stocks, real estate, et cetera. And then be mindful of what the valuations of those are. We don't want to be naive passive investors. We can use passive vehicles like index funds, but we don't want to be naive. We want to understand what's under the hood and where we are, what's the current market's temperature, so that we can make educated rebalancing decisions or reduce risk when appropriate or take advantage of opportunities. Because the markets gradually change and opportunities arise, and we don't have to outsmart other people to take advantage of that. That's the last thing we want. That's why I don't invest in individual stocks, because it's an auction market. And I have to know more than whoever's selling me that stock. And I don't. So I would rather benefit from the collection of stocks. So it's driven by the cash flows and the cash flow growth, what's going on in the economy, versus, will this stock do better than what everybody expects? And do I know more than everybody else so that it will do better and surprise the upside and do very, very well? We want our investing to be depending on underlying drivers, not outsmarting other investors.
That's a great point. The REIT thing, you were talking about REITs. You still think REITs are a good idea?
Yeah. I mean, they're yielding 4%. I mean, it is a equity REITs. I mean, these are real estate operating companies that own all kinds of real estate. They own retail stores, they own cell towers, they own self storage, they own single family homes. And they're a very efficient way to get exposure to well-run commercial real estate. And people say, well, what about what's going on in the office sector? Well, if you buy a REIT ETF or index fund, it owns all the sectors. And these things change over time. So office is less than 10% of the equity REIT indexes. And there's all types of other things. And so we like equity REITs because most of us can't go invest in an institutional private real estate fund. And so equity REITs is a very liquid way to get exposure to commercial real estate in the U.S. and around the world.
Yeah, and you could also own you know, cloud computing REITs and healthcare REITs and all these, you know, there's a REIT for anything, you know.
Well, when the weights change based on the how the market evolves. And it's not, you know, REIT managers, you know, they're smart, right? You look at what's going on with the mall space. For years, you know, malls, this is awful. Well, malls change. There's a mall here in Tucson. They tore half of it down to redevelop. It's owned by a mall company. And so real estate changes, and this is how we participate in it. We can pick up that 4% yield, and then if they can grow their earnings, you know, 3% or so, that's a 7% return for REITs per year over the next decade.
Oh yeah, malls are a great opportunity. I mean, they were trading at such discounts. I know the Kushners bought some big mall in New Jersey, you know, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law or whatever. And people were, you know, this dead mall is now going to be converted into, you know, 10,000 apartment units.
Yeah. Right.
And they're all selling out. And luxury, you know, they're getting the luxury shops in. And, you know, it's more like mixed use.
Right. Building. You see that more. Right.
And then Macy's are being converted into Amazon warehouses and stuff. So, they're not making any more land.
And that's where, the land's not going anywhere. And so the uses for what's built on the land changes over time. And that's, you know, as long-term investors, we can participate in that, which is why we invest in, you know, index funds and ETFs in the stock market. The market evolves over time. And that's why global diversification makes so much sense, because you can see it's so much cheaper now versus what's going on in the U.S. And you still own U.S., but we just did an episode on Japan. Japan just surpassed its all-time high from 1989 last month, February 2024. Took 34 years. 0% price appreciation for 34 years. And the Japanese stock market went from 38% of the global stock market down to 6%. And Japan was, you know, they were the king at the time, back in the late 80s. And things can change. The U.S. makes up 58% of the global stock market. It's up from 50% 6 or 7 years ago. Things could change. There is no guarantee that the U.S. is going to stay where it's at in terms of its size of the stock market. So it's better to own some stocks outside of the U.S. At least 42% outside of your stock portfolio, perhaps more.
But the average person is 95, 90% U.S. or 99%.
Oh, I know. And that's what they call that home country bias. And it's worked. Like, it has worked over the past decade. But they thought that would work in Japan too. The PE, so Japan got up to 50, the price to earnings ratio. We're not quite there yet in the US. We're a cyclically adjusted PE, we're at 30 in the US. So it could go higher, but why not hedge a little bit and have money that you can buy stocks at a PE of 15? The hurdle rate's much lower there.
But people do this. I remember emerging markets was the big thing in the 2000 to 2010 decade, because, and now then they're all
because
these
they outperformed the U.S. because they did incredibly well because they were super cheap in 2002.
So maybe we'll go there again.
Well, yeah, we might.
But you have a good point. You know why? I always think of like what are kids doing? You know what are people 18 doing? They're on Temu. They're on TikTok. What's crazy? None of those things are U.S. companies.
No, they're not, right?
And even my friend who's the Google SEO guy kind of warning me of Google losing its dominance. You know, if you think about it, reminds me of Cisco. You brought up Cisco in the early 2000s.
Right.
And I remember Cisco, Microsoft, and Intel did nothing for like 10 straight years. Right. The best time to buy those stocks was like in 2010 or something. And nobody wanted them then.
growth stocks, big cap growth stocks, ultimately disappoint. It's just a question of when. They usually do. There's just a turnover. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, David Stein. Money for the rest of us. Where can people go to find out more about your community?
I think go to moneyfortherestofus.com is where our community is. And then our second URL is assetcamp.com, where we provide data tools and education on the stock market.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. So go to assetcamp.com. Also, get his book, Money for the Rest of Us, 10 Questions to Master Successful Investing. Really enjoyed the interview. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Josh.